books and accessible reading on RNIB Connect Radio. For everyone who loves books, this is Read On, the audiobook show on RNIB Connect Radio.
Hello and welcome to Read On, the audiobook show, recorded in collaboration with RNIB Talking Books. I'm your host, Robert Kirkwood, and I'm not here just now. If you're listening to this on the day of release or the following weekend, I'm at the Boswell Book Festival recording for a future edition of Read On. But today, let's take a listen to some interviews I've recorded in the past at Dumfries House in Ayrshire. Coming up on today's selection of interviews from the Boswell Book Festival, we'll be cloistered with Catherine Coldstream. We'll hear from the author of Agent Zigzag, Operation Mincemeat and many others, biographer Ben McIntyre. Commentator and author Andrew Cotter tells us about his dogs Olive and Mabel. Plus, we've got a royal lady-in-waiting, Winston Churchill's granddaughter and the founder of Private Eye.
All that and more on today's Read On.
Lady in Waiting, My Extraordinary Life in the Shadow of the Crown, is a memoir of drama, tragedy and royal secrets by Anne Glenconner, a close member of the royal circle and lady in waiting to Prince Margaret. She has been at the centre of the royal circle from childhood, when she met and befriended the future Queen Elizabeth II and her sister, the Princess Margaret. Though the firstborn child of the 5th Earl of Leicester, who controlled one of the largest estates in England, as a daughter she was deemed the greatest disappointment and unable to inherit. Since then she has needed all her resilience to survive court life with her sense of humour intact. A unique witness to landmark moments in royal history, Lady in Waiting is written and narrated by Anne Glenconner.
One morning at the beginning of 2019, when I was in my London flat, the telephone rang. Hello, Lady Glenconner, it's Helena Bonham Carter. It's not every day a Hollywood film star rings me up, although I had been expecting her call. When the producers of the popular Netflix series The Crown contacted me, saying that I was going to be portrayed by Nancy Carroll in the third series, and that Helena Bonham Carter had been cast as Princess Margaret, I was delighted. Asked whether I minded meeting them so they could get a better idea of my friendship with Princess Margaret, I said I didn't mind in the least. Nancy Carroll came to tea, and we sat in armchairs in my sitting room and talked. The conversation was surreal, as I became extremely self-aware, realising that Nancy must be absorbing what I was like. I was asked to write a book when I was 87, and I said, well, I can't possibly do that. I'm far too old. So they said, oh, well, dictate it. Sit and just dictate it. And it worked very, very well, because I've sold nearly a million copies. It's been translated into 14 different languages, and I'm going to be 90 this summer. So it's never too late to, you know. I feel extremely lucky to be in this position, and I'm delighted to be in Scotland for the Boswell Literary Festival at Dumfries House. Heard so much about it, and we went yesterday to see the Wall Garden, which I thought was completely magical.
Now, what I think is remarkable is you narrated the audio version of the book yourself.
Oh, yes, well, I did. My great friend is Rupert Everett, the actor, and I said I was going to read it, and he said, no, Anne, that would be too difficult, it's too exhausting, which made me absolutely determined that I would do it. But I did have one of the sort of unexpected things, my tongue swelled up. I talked every day for about 5 hours, so I had to suck cubes of ice. Anyway, I did it, and I think a lot of people have liked it and have said, you know, that because I read it, it means much more to people. My earliest memories of Princess Elizabeth and Princess Margaret came from when I was 2 or 3 years old. Princess Elizabeth 5 years older, which was quite a lot. She's rather grown up. But Princess Margaret was only 3 years older, and we became firm friends. She was naughty, funny, and imaginative, the very best sort of friend to have. We used to rush round Holkham, past the grand pictures, whirling through the labyrinth of corridors on our trikes, or jumping out at the nursery footmen as they carried huge silver trays from the kitchen. Princess Elizabeth was much better behaved. "Please don't do that, Margaret," or "You shouldn't do that, Anne," she would scold us. In one photograph, we are all standing in a line. Princess Elizabeth is frowning at Princess Margaret, suspecting she's up to no good, while Princess Margaret is staring down at my shoes. Years afterwards, I show Princess Margaret the photo and ask, "Ma'am, why were you looking at my feet?" And she replied, "Well, I'm so jealous because you had silver shoes and I had brown ones."
And of course, you're in the public eye at the moment because you were depicted in The Crown. Did you watch it?
Well, I didn't actually watch The Crown. I did watch the bit I was in. I couldn't resist. It was absolute rubbish, really, but quite fun. I don't think the royal family watched it. I must say, I don't blame them. But actually, when it first started, being one of the maids of honour, we had a special showing, and that was rather good. I think it started off rather well, and then I think it's gone completely off-piste at the moment. The bit I was in, I hoped that it would be filmed, because my husband's family home is in Peeblesham, the Glen, just above Traquair, and I rather hope they might film it there, but I think that that was probably too expensive. So they filmed it in the really grotty country club, and I'm sitting by a pool, Princess Margaret and me, in sort of bikinis, and I'm sort of pimping for her. I'm saying, "Look, ma'am, do you like that young man over there? Hasn't he got a cute bottom?" You know, I mean, complete rubbish. I'm so glad that darling Princess Margaret is no longer, and so she wasn't able to see it with me, because it would have been very, very embarrassing.
Lady in Waiting, My Extraordinary Life in the Shadow of the Crown by Anne Glenconner is available both commercially and from RNIB Talking Books. Also available in the RNIB Talking Books library since that recording is Whatever Next, Lessons from an Unexpected Life, written and narrated by Anne Glenconner.
Just when I'd imagined life's great adventures to be over, I had the unexpected joy of becoming an author in my 80s, writing my autobiography, Lady in Waiting. Since then, I've made many personal appearances, telling my stories and answering questions, which have also been great fun. Audiences have always been fascinated by my tales of Princess Margaret and my husband Colin Tennant, Lord Glenconner. But to my surprise, they've also been very curious about me and about my own background. They wanted to know more about who I am as a person, as a modern expression goes, and what got me through the darker times of my life. Many of them said they felt inspired by my gung-ho attitude, my sense of humour, and the energy with which I'm still attacking life. I'm particularly delighted to learn I've become an unofficial agony aunt, as well as a gay icon. This flattering reaction has given me pause and made me look again at the events that have shaped me, what I was taught about life in my youth, and what in turn life has taught me. This book is the result. Writing it has given me a chance to reflect on the world in which I was brought up, and how I've ended up who I am and where I am. It has also given me the chance to talk openly about some things I've kept private until now.
Whatever Next, Lessons from an Unexpected Life by Anne Glenconner, is available now in audio and braille, and it can be found alongside The Life and Adventures of William Cobbett by Richard Ingrams, founder of Private Eye. When I met him at the Boswell Book Festival, I asked him what book he was there to talk about.
Ludo and the Power of the Book is my book, and it's not a biography of Ludovic Kennedy. It's been described as that, but it's not really a biography. It really consists of four quite different murder stories in which Ludo was involved, not discovering the guilty man, but in proving that the guilty man was in fact innocent in each case. He was originally got involved in the cause of miscarriage of justice when he was asked to review a book about the Rillington Place, the famous Rillington Place case involving Timothy Evans, who had been convicted of murdering his wife and his baby, when in fact, as emerged later on, they had been murdered along with several other women by a man living in the same house, John Christie. Evans was hanged for murder, although he was quite innocent, as later became clear. And Ludo wrote a book about that called Ten Rillington Place, which became a famous book and was very instrumental in bringing about the repeal of capital punishment in England, which eventually took place, I think, in 1965. But after that, having written that book, he became the target for lots of people who thought that they'd been wrongly convicted. And my book is about the Rillington Place story, but also three other cases. One, the case of Paddy Meehan, the Glasgow criminal. The Luton Post Office murder of 1975, which is a famous case. And finally, the kidnapping of the baby boy and murder of baby boy of Charles Lindbergh, the famous American pilot, first man to fly across the Atlantic single-handed.
That seems a very serious book for someone who used to edit Private Eye.
Well, I hope it's not too serious. There's a lot of good jokes in it. Ludo himself was a very lively, humorous character who was particularly good at saying rude things about judges, which is partly why he appealed to me, because I've had a certain experience of that.
Now, tell us about the founding of Private Eye.
Well, Private Eye sprung up really as a result of a group of people, who myself included, who were friends from school and university. And we started in 1961 with no money at all. And by lucky chance, really, it took off. And that was partly due to the fact that of the political situation at that time, where the Tories had been in power for a long period, and there was a move, a discontent, which took its form of political satire, which notably flourished in the famous TV program That Was the Week That Was. That came along after Private Eye started, actually. But thanks to that particular situation at that time, Private Eye took off, and it was brought up after about six issues by Peter Cook, who remained the owner of Private Eye until he died. And that was a very fortuitous thing that happened, because he was obviously a very funny man and was helped in that way, but he was also his proprietor. He never interfered at all in the running of the magazine, so that the editor, which was myself, had complete freedom to do whatever he liked. And that situation has remained the case even after Peter's death. The editor, Ian Hislop, has been free to do whatever he likes. And that's a very unusual situation.
We've had the writing of Alan Corran on the show before. Now, Alan Corran was editor of Punch while you were editor of Private Eye. Was there a rivalry?
Well, we were sort of rivals. We used to appear on the BBC's news quiz every week, or whenever it was on, anyway. I think Private Eye did have a feeling about Punch from the very early days, that we were going to... Willie Rushton used to say, we're going to knock Punch off his perch. And there was a certain attitude about that towards Punch, and to Alan in particular, I suppose.
Now, one thing I've always wondered about Private Eye, see those wee adverts in the back where it's please help and a bank account number and a sort code, do they ever work?
Well, I'm told that they do. otherwise, they wouldn't appear. I mean, it seems amazing, but there it is.
Now, you've moved on to the oldie.
Yeah, that, again, was started almost as an accident by a group of friends, including myself. We managed to get a backer for it in the shape of Naima Tullett. And again, like Private Eye, it had a tricky start because we didn't have the amount of capital you really need to start a new paper. But again, thanks to a series of strokes of good fortune, it survived. And it's still coming out today after 25 years. 25 years.
And thanks once again to Richard Ingrams.
For everyone who loves books, this is Read On, the audiobook show on RNIB Connect Radio.
You're listening to Read on RNIB Connect Radio. This week's show recorded on location at the Boswell Book Festival. Next up, biographer Ben McIntyre. Thrilling tales of espionage and deception are Ben's stock in trade, so I asked him what book he was talking about today.
I'm here to talk about The Spy and the Traitor, which is my book about Oleg Gordievsky, who was, I think you can back up this, he was probably the most important single spy of the Cold War. Oleg was a KGB officer who came over to the West, came over to MI6 in about 1972, and for a decade he produced intelligence of the highest quality. The things that really astonished me was the way that in common with very few other spies, the information he was producing was going not only straight to 10 Downing Street, but going straight to the president's desk in the Oval Office. He was actually strategically altering the policy of those states. And in a way, we imagine spies are sort of offensive weapons. Actually, what Oleg Gordievsky did was to pave the way for the beginning of the end of the Cold War, because he alerted the West to the fact that the Kremlin genuinely believed the West was going to launch a first strike, that the attack was going to come from the West, and they were gearing up, looking for evidence of a first strike. And when that arrived on Reagan's desk, it had a pretty dramatic effect on him. You can see this in the rhetoric, he began to scale down the sort of language he was using, and you can see the beginning of a thaw coming in.
So this is a much more modern book.
Yes, I mean, I'm still obsessed by the war, of course. It is still the field of great espionage, but I was very keen to write this one because Oleg is still alive. Oleg is able to tell one. I mean, he has a phenomenal memory. He's able to tell you what it smelled like in a particular room in the Lubyanka in 1962. And he has almost perfect recall. So for me, really having living witnesses was absolutely vital. And it's something I've never really had in my books before. I've relied on a lot of documentary evidence. I've relied on a lot of memoir. I've relied on sort of what people's recollections were at the time. But in very few cases have I been able to ask the individuals themselves what it was like. And this one's been very different that way. And I've really enjoyed it. It's been a complete departure for me, really.
Yeah, it sounds like it, because your books are based on information that was released all of a sudden. All these files were available, but you're actually interviewing someone who's alive now.
Absolutely, and what makes that interesting is, of course, that you're reliant on memory, and memory is a very fallible and changeable quality, put it that way. We all remember things differently. We can very often remember the same event in completely different ways. And one of the extraordinary things about this story was that Oleg, although he has a brilliant memory, because it's a very long time since a lot of these things happened, 35 years since he escaped, you know, his memory has kind of solidified, if you like. But because I had access to all the MI6 officers who had run him during that period, I was able to kind of, as it were, triangulate and work out what the genuine answer was. And it was a bit strange in a way to be able to sort of approach the main subject of your book and say to him, Oleg, I'm not sure it was exactly the way that you remembered it. That there were moments of some tension at those points.
Now, talking of getting information from the source, after you wrote your book Agent Zigzag, did you find then footage of the man?
Yes, that's right. We set out to make a documentary about him, and astonishingly, in a cupboard at the back of the BBC, we found these unused tapes of Eddie Chapman, who was Agent Zigzag, who was a sort of extraordinary double agent during the Second World War. He'd actually filmed them. This was the old days. He'd filmed this for a film about crooks. In fact, I mean, he was a professional criminal.
Yeah.
That was his trade. Although he ended up as the crime correspondent of the Daily Telegraph, which I've always enjoyed. But so this was a film made about crooks. But the interviewer had obviously got fascinated by Chapman's earlier life and just simply kept the camera running and kept it running for 4 hours. So there were 4 hours of completely virgin tape in which Eddie Chapman quite happily sort of breezed along about all the crimes and the double stuff that he'd done over the years, which then formed the basis of the documentary that we made.
Agent Zigzag starts with him jumping out a plate glass window and running away. What's the comparison to him and Oleg? I think Oleg's a bit of a more subdued character.
Well, they're different creatures. I mean, they're both engaged in the espionage game, but Chapman is an agent. I mean, Chapman is someone who was recruited by intelligence to do a certain thing. First by one side and then by the other and then by the first side again and then by the other, hence Agent Zigzag. So, but he's an agent. I mean, he is, as if you like, a tool of espionage. Oleg is a completely different creature. Oleg is a professional intelligence officer. He was, if you like, his equivalent is Kim Philby for us. He was deep within the Soviet intelligence system, and then he was peeled off to work for the other intelligence system. So that's, in a way, that's the gold dust of intelligence. If you've got someone inside the other machine telling you not only what that machine is doing, but what they're thinking of doing, then you're several steps ahead. So Chapman is a different sort of creature. That said, I think they'd probably get on quite well.
What are you working on at the moment?
Well, I'm actually going back in time a little bit now. I'm going back to a wartime, pre-war and immediately post-war story of a woman agent. I've never written from a woman's perspective before. And she, again, I won't say too much about her, but she was a Soviet agent. She was one of the very, very few women who not only survived in this world, this very male-dominated world of espionage, but actually thrived. She was completely brilliant. And again, a little like Oleg, she strategically changed the world that we live in.
And where is the bulk of your information coming from?
Well, in that one, it comes from all sorts of different places. In that case, some living witnesses, her family are still alive. They have their own archive of material, lots of letters and photographs and memoirs, poems, diaries, that kind of thing. So some of it is that kind of material. MI5 has a very large archive on this particular person. There is more to come, and more will come, I suspect. And then there are her own writings. I mean, she wrote very voluminously, some published and some unpublished. So then there is also a lot in the KGB archives, harder to get to. In fact, she wasn't KGB, she was GRU, she was the Soviet military intelligence. So there is quite a lot of material there. So there's actually a sort of embarrassment of riches here.
And will there be an audio version of The Spy and the Traitor?
Certainly, yep. No, that's been done. I do it myself, so it took quite a lot of recording, but I love recording them, actually. It makes you think about what you've written in a slightly different way.
I was talking to Kate Williams earlier, as she read some of her own work. Did you resist the urge to change it?
Yes, I did. I did. I resisted that completely. I mean, I think you can't have two different versions of the book, one to be listening to, one to... Although, interestingly, I mean, I don't know if I'm particularly good at reading my own books. I know some people are brilliant at reading my books. I mean, Simon Russell Beale did a version of the Kim Philby book that I wrote some years back for the BBC when it was Book of the Week. And he read it so brilliantly. It made me actually think about what I'd written in a slightly different way. It wasn't just that he gave life to the characters. It was that he gave a slightly different, because he's such a brilliant man, Simon Russell Beale. He actually had thought about the book in a very profound way. And it was fascinating to hear it performed. All books should be available in all possible ways. I mean, I'm stunned by the increase, and it's such an encouraging thing, in the audiobook world. I mean, it is growing at a wonderful, he said, I get a royalty, but it's actually growing at a wonderful pace. And, you know, I have children who are now in their 20s. They consume books in a very different way from the way than we did. They don't carry them around, although they do sometimes, they carry them around in paperback or hardback form. But increasingly, they're listening to them, they're taking them in podcasts, they're doing them in all sorts of different ways. And I think that can only be a brilliant development.
Thank you very much.
Great pleasure.
Many of Ben's books, including Agent Zigzag, Operation Mincemeats and Rogue Heroes, are available in audio from RNIB.
You're listening to Read On, the audiobook show with Robert Kirkwood.
RNIB Talking Books provides more than 1 million audiobooks every year to people with sight loss and is now completely free for all blind and partially sighted people in the UK. The RNIB library is the largest of its kind in Europe and offers a wide range of fiction and non-fiction titles, which readers can access on CD, on USB, or as a digital download, so that you can listen how you choose, whether at home or on the go. To find out more about the RNIB library or to sign up for your free membership, call the RNIB helpline on 0303 123 9999 or visit www.rnib.org.uk/library.
And next on Read On, as we get a flavour for the Boswell Book Festival, here's Emma Soames talking about her book Mary Churchill's War, the wartime diaries of Churchill's youngest daughter.
Mary was just 16 years old when she resolved to keep a diary at the beginning of 1939. Her early entries capture the innocence of the last days of her childhood, spent in comparative isolation in the beautiful countryside around Chartwell, the family home in Kent. Her religious faith and her love of riding are evident, while episodes of teenage angst are interspersed with occasional forays into a more glamorous adult world. She is unquestioningly loyal to her papa, but initially at least, the political news and deteriorating international situation only occasionally intrude into her cosy domestic narrative.
Emma Soames is a legendary journalist, former editor of the Literary Review, Tatler, Saga, Evening Standard and Telegraph magazines, and she's also the granddaughter of Winston Churchill. In her book, Mary Churchill's War, she edits her mother's diaries, many of which have never been published, and provides a unique front row view of the great events of war, as well as exchanges and intimate moments with her father. They also show an impulsive and spirited writer, untrammelled by hindsight or self-censorship, or nostalgia. In 1939, 17-year-old Mary found herself in an extraordinary position at an extraordinary time. It was the outbreak of the Second World War, and her father, Winston Churchill, had been appointed First Lord of the Admiralty. Within months, he would be Prime Minister. The young Mary Churchill was uniquely placed to observe this remarkable historical moment, but also capture what it was like to be a young woman during wartime.
Mary accompanies her parents to France in August, though the worsening political situation means that her father both goes out first and comes back early. Suddenly, war seems so horribly near, so inevitable. On the 1st of September, Germany moves against Poland after having first secured a non-aggression pact with the Soviet Union. Prime Minister Chamberlain recalls Churchill to the War Cabinet as First Lord of the Admiralty. 2 days later, the British ultimatum to Berlin expires and war with Germany is declared. They are the wartime diaries of my mother, who it was called Mary Soames, but before that, when she wrote them, she was Mary Churchill, and she was the youngest daughter of the War Prime Minister, Winston Churchill.
And how did the book come about?
Well, she left her diaries to Churchill College, Cambridge, to the Archive Centre. And after her death, I'm her literary executor, and we looked at the diaries and decided that although she had used some of the material out of the diaries in her memoir, A Daughter's Tale, there was lots of other rich things in the years she covered, and so we decided to publish.
Sunday the 1st of January. Saw 1939 out and 1939 in with Punch at Breckles. Went for longish walk in AM with Nana. Walked again in PM, Great fun and most energetic, read mainly after tea. My resolutions are 1. To say prayers much more carefully. 2. To be much more regular, read letters, accounts, etc., and especially my zoo is to be attended to. 3. To have greater strength of purpose. 4. To keep a diary. 5. To read lots of good books. I am really going to try to keep these. May God bless my year and be with all those I love.
Now, you're an editor yourself. How hard was it to decide what to leave in and what to cut out?
Well, really, there was certainly no sort of censorship. But for length, I did cut. Really, where it's a bit repetitious. I mean, you know, like all teenagers, she did go on a bit about her state of mind or her, you know, her appearance or something. So we kept a bit of that, but at the same time, we took out the repetitious bits.
And she said some of it may have been hot-making?
Yes. Her word for embarrassing was hot-making. And I think some of these diaries she would have regarded as hot-making because they were a teenager, an innocent teenager talking. But that is also part of their charm.
You read some of the audiobook. How was that?
Yes, I've read all the bits that aren't my mother talking, because obviously I do not sound like a 17-year-old girl. But I've read the introduction. I read the introduction of each year. At the beginning of each year, we've got a page or so explaining what was going on in the war and in the world at that point, which makes it then when you start reading the text of the diaries, you don't have to keep thinking what was going on then. I read all that, and then there's a very good actress who the publishers use a lot, and she reads, she is my mother.
Friday, 6th of January. Read and finished Bleak House during day. I enjoyed it very much, but the ending was not altogether satisfactory, what with Richard dying and Caddy's baby being a deaf mute. And anyway, I don't believe I ever got over Esther being pockmarked. Road in PM. Fears rehunting because of frost. After tea, rang up Sam Marsh, who runs the local riding school. No hunting. Boo-hoo. But 2 hours later, Sam Marsh rang me. Weather forecasts and thaw made prospect of hunting probable. Whoopee! Oh dear, God is so wonderful. I do appreciate everything he does.
I think she's done a very good job, and it you know, it bounces along at quite a good pace. It's not sort of, you know, you don't long to put 1.5, increase the speed. You don't feel like doing that.
Now, during your talk, and just to end this, you told about your big brother.
Yes. So when he was a very old man living at Chartwell, my elder brother, Nicholas, once bounced into his study and said, "Grandpapa, Grandpapa, is it true that you're England's greatest man?" And Grandpapa said, "Yes, now bugger off."
Saturday, 18th of March. The German invasion of Czechoslovakia crisis seems to be becoming more serious. Papa said, "Before God Almighty, I swear I do not wish for war." I write this as a witness.
From air raid sirens at 10 Downing Street to seeing action with the ETS, from cocktail parties with presidents and royals to accompanying her father on key diplomatic trips, Mary's wartime diaries are full of colour, rich in historical insight and a charming and intimate portrait of life alongside Winston Churchill. They're narrated by Beth Eyer and Emma Soames and available commercially now.
Love books? Well, R&IB Library has a world of books and loads more reading for you to enjoy. And you can choose from Braille and talking books. For more info, head to rniblibrary.com or call our expert team on 0303 123 9999. R&IB Library, here for all your reading needs.
Andrew Cotter is one of the most recognisable voices in sports broadcasting. He is a freelancer, but is regarded as one of the leading commentators on the BBC's golf, rugby, tennis and athletics coverage. Among the many events he's covered are the Olympics, Wimbledon, the Masters, Open and Ryder Cup, the Six Nations, Rugby World Cup, World Athletics Championships and the boat race. When sporting events were cancelled at the start of lockdown, he began posting videos of his Labradors, Olive and Mabel. They went viral and have been watched millions of times. He was at the Boswell Book Festival to talk about his two books, Dog Days, A Year with Olive and Mabel, and Olive, Mabel and Me, Life and Adventures with Two Very Good Dogs. Both books are narrated by Andrew himself.
Dogs love to be trained, or at least to play a game that challenges whatever brain cells they might possess. They are very willing to learn, but the trouble is that they don't get bored with the process quite as quickly as we might. We had also been reliably informed that dogs, or certainly Labradors, are desperate to please their owners, and that this can be used very effectively in training. But with my experience of labs now, I believe there is a clear hierarchy in their heads of what is most important. 1. Food. 2. Food. 3. Food. 4. Also food. 5. Human approval. And I'm not even sure that human approval should be as high as number 5.
At the Boswell Book Festival, I asked Andrew Cotter how he introduced the world to Olive and Mabel.
I introduced the world to Olive and Mabel by being a little bit bored, as I think I said in the first tweet, but also through being out of work and not having anything as a sports broadcaster left, so I just decided to commentate on Olive and Mabel having their breakfast.
And now they go, Olive away first, but a problem with Mabel's ball. That might cost her now, having to play catch-up. Both settling quickly into rhythm. You can see the contrast in styles. Mabel, heavy tail use, happy to be alive. Everything's amazing. Olive, more steady, wasting little energy. Very much of the old Labrador school, eating's a serious business. And Mabel seems just a little sluggish here. Perhaps more was taken out of her by the worm medicine she was given last night than we thought.
Put it out on Twitter and it just exploded. It went up to about 10 million views very quickly. And it kind of took off from there. There's another video a couple of weeks later with them fighting over a bone, and that had over 20 million views. So it started from there and it just kept on going, really.
And there's the change from the classic hold. Still placed on the outside, though great technique. And a glance at the youngster who shows little emotion, but her mind will be empty. 20 seconds to go now. Olive closing in on victory and that coveted prize of being told she's a very good dog. One paw to control and a switch. Now Mabel sensing this might be a chance, still waiting, still believing.
But you decided to keep putting the videos up, but to stop actually commentating on them in case it infiltrated into your own work.
Well, yeah, I mean, the thing is, I knew that sports broadcasting was going to come back, and so I was going to have to go back and commentate at Wimbledon or on the Six Nations or at the Olympics or whatever, and I didn't want to be the joke commentator, the parody commentator. I wanted to have some credibility if there was just a shred of that still left. And I got lots of offers at the time, and they were tempting because I didn't have any work, lots of offers to do ads, to do commercials, but they wanted me to do joke commentary, commentate on rental cars being cleaned or pizza being cooked or things like that. And it just wasn't for me, really. Also, I didn't want it to become anything commercial because it was sort of a charming escape. And as soon as you attach it to a product, it becomes something very different. But I didn't want to be that funny commentator because, you know, and I have had cause when I've been doing commentary since, you know, Wimbledon I was commentating and I remember using a phrase. I remember saying when Andy Murray was trying to come back into a match, saying, Murray then, still waiting, still believing. And I'd used that phrase before and I couldn't remember where, and then I remembered that I'd used it describing Mabel waiting to get the bone from Olive. So I didn't want to be the funny commentator forever and a day, so hopefully there's still, as I said, a shred of seriousness and credibility left.
Quite quickly, we realised that receiving our gratitude and being told that she was a very good girl came pretty low down the list of priorities, and we ended up instead relying on Olive's overwhelming greed to do the training for us. Here's a good trick if you have a Labrador. Actually, trick does it a disservice. It is a recognised training aid. When they're young, every time they're eating a meal, you blow a whistle, short and sharp, over and over again throughout the whole dining experience. Perhaps Olive felt that I was like a one-note version of the guitarist in a hokey restaurant who sidles up to the table just as you're enjoying your starter. But the results were devastatingly effective. Subsequently, any time on a walk where Olive's concentration drifted to some other matter, or she wandered off, there was a solemn nod from me to Caroline, and the nuclear option was taken. A few blasts on the whistle, and she would lift her head from whatever she'd been doing, eating grass, eating sticks, eating a child's apple and fingers, and come sprinting to us as if her life depended on it. All for a tiny morsel of training treat, and because we had conditioned her brain like evil geniuses. Yet this was a minor triumph in a battle of wills. Olive has long since won the war. It's mostly our fault for training her in a rather half-hearted way, or abandoning it when we thought we had it cracked. Labradors are some of the most trainable dogs you'll find, but you still have to work at it. We only did a bit, and as a result, Olive will obey us, but only when she decides that it's in her own interests.
So how did those videos become two books?
Well, it was interesting. I suppose after the third video, which was just me commentating on Mabel standing in a pond doing very little indeed, publishers are in the business of trying to sell books, and so they saw that there was a big, big audience building for this thing. You know, they were finishing US news bulletins every night on MSNBC. There was a guy who'd finish with, whenever I did an Olive and Mabel video, they'd finish with that. So they realised that it was a big worldwide audience as well, and so they sort of leapt on the back of that and said, look, how would you fancy writing a book about this experience, but also about your love for Olive Mabel and your love for dogs? And it became something. I was very keen for it to be a decent standalone book. Even if you hadn't seen the videos, you might enjoy the book. So I didn't want it just to be seen to be sort of cashing in on the videos. I enjoyed the book writing process, and I hope people have enjoyed the books as well.
And you narrated both of the books, and you've also narrated books by the great Dodie Weir.
Yeah.
How do you find that, working from a script?
Well, doing an audiobook is absolutely invaluable. I listen to audiobooks, and obviously lots of people have to listen to audiobooks to get their writing or reading experience. So I enjoyed it for that. The actual process of reading it, though, is quite difficult. It's quite time-consuming. Because when you're reading a book, you're not reading it out loud. You're sort of you're skim-reading it, really, in a way. And you find yourself sometimes just almost floating over a page and doing it very quickly. And you're taking it in, but you're not enunciating every word and every syllable. So when you're reading an audiobook, and also I was reading it and I would think, oh, I can do that line a bit better. And so I was doing about four or five takes. And of course, inevitably, it's the first take that sounds the best anyway. So you have to, by the time I did the second book, and I'd done a couple of Dodie's books as well, I was very much, it should probably sound a bit more natural than trying to get it to sound perfect. So, and you want to, with Dodie's books, also I don't sound like Dodie at all. So it was more about just trying to get his character out on the page, and you know, the humour and the pathos in there as well in those stories. So it's not that you act out the story, but I suppose that's why so many actors are used for it, but that you do try and bring the book to life.
And finally, out of Olive and Mabel, what one do you think would make the best guide dog?
Well, I know who would make the best guide dog, and that's Olive, because although, having said that, she would be... leading her owner across along the street, and she'd get distracted by food somewhere. So, but she would be more easily trainable than Mabel, who is, dare I say it, not quite as bright as Olive. There, I've dared to say it. I don't mind. It's true. It doesn't mean I love her any less. Possibly even more. No, I love them both equally. But I think in terms of being able to be trained, Olive would be better. Having said that, neither of them would pass the tests. They would be chucked out of school at a very early age, I think.
They wandered the hall during your talk, and they were getting a lot of attention here at your signing. Do they love the attention?
I think they do. I think Mabel loves to be touched by humans and be sort of reassured that everything's okay. Olive loves to be touched by humans and then given food by humans. So, yeah, they're Labradors. They've got the best natures. They, you know, they're some dogs, you know, through a breed or through the way they have been treated, are very wary of humans, but Olive and Mabel are about as far from that as you're likely to find.
Thank you so
Cheers.
Much for that.
No, you're very welcome. I enjoyed it. It's a beautiful place to come and do a talk at Dumfries House. The sun is shining. Olive and Mabel have wandered off into the grass and are probably eating it as we speak.
Oh, there they come.
Right on cue, they come back.
Hello.
We finally signed the Treaty of Surrender when, after 2 years of existing beneath us, staying in her bed or on the floor, she very nonchalantly one evening hopped up alongside Caroline on the sofa with a look that said, "This is happening, get used to it." It was a moment of huge physical and metaphorical significance. She had risen to our level, brazenly suggesting that she was now equal to us in standing. The next move would be crucial, and the absolutely correct thing to do was to briskly shoo her back down to the floor with a scolding word. It might sound unkind, but it had to be done if we were to maintain order, discipline, and whatever dwindling respect she had for us. Instead, they both settled down to watch Coronation Street.
Olive, Mabel and me, life and adventures with two very good dogs, and Dog Days, a year with Olive and Mabel, both written and read by Andrew Cotter, are available in print, ebook, and in audio.
This is an RNIB Talking Book.
History of the Talking Book service and studios. The first Talking Books to be sent to listeners were on LPs made of shellac.
A shellac is like a very thick plastic, and you know, if you drop them, they just shattered, basically. The average length book, let's say 10, 12 hours, so you're talking 10, 15 discs, perhaps. They were stored in very durable boxes with large straps going around them. And those durable boxes held these discs and were sent out by post in the same sort of way as we do now, of course.
Today, RNIB Talking Books are part of the RNIB National Library Service, offering books in audio, braille, along with many other benefits such as braille music scores, online forums, and much more. Joining is simple. If you're eligible to join, call 0303 123 9999 or email library@rnib.org.uk. That's 0303 123 9999 or email library@rnib.org.uk.
Talking Books on RNIB Connects Radio.
And finally, on today's show, recorded over the years at the Boswell Book Festival. Cloistered is Catherine Coldstream's evocative account of life as a nun in the 1990s and the dramatic events which led to her flight from the monastery. After the shock of her father's death, 24-year-old Catherine was left grieving and alone. A search for meaning led her to Roman Catholicism and the nuns of the Akenside Priory. There she found a tight-knit community of dedicated women and peace in an ancient way of life. But as she surrenders to her final vows, all is not as it seems behind the priory's closed doors. The audio version of Cloistered, My Years as a Nun is read by its author, Catherine Coldstream.
In my mind, I'm still running, running towards the road, running, running, running. The darkness is fresh around me, the air slicing across my face in wild, clean shafts. The rush of oxygen is fizzing, moonlit, completely unexpected. I'd forgotten what night tasted like, a great dome of it, just as I'd forgotten what it was, after 10 years cloistered, to run cold and wild and wet beyond enclosure. I'd forgotten what it was to stand under the sky and feel the far stretching of infinity. I'd forgotten what it was to stand and look up and turn and twizzle my head this way and that, amazed, engulfed in stars. I'd forgotten what it was to move and breathe and spread wide my arms and feel no walls. Now I am running fast and newly free, my feet sunk in wet greenery on the grass verge. My socks are damp, my ankles brushed by foliage. The first shock, after the careful terror of the locks and keys, the infinitesimal turning of the handle, had been the floodlighting that rose up before me, sweeping the gravel forecourt like a great white whale as I stepped out. For a moment, I had thought that was it. The game was up. There would be an alarm. There would be footsteps rushing, voices, torches. My mind spooled. I just stood very still and looked, took in the frightening, glorious wide space in front of me, the beam of the lights over gravel, and decided there was nothing for it but to go on. Beyond the lights were dark trees. Beyond that there were fields, black carpets of freedom only bumpily illuminated in places by the moon.
Cloistered is about the 12 years I spent as a contemplative nun in a Carmelite monastery in the north of England. And it's about how I went in there after my father died. I was 24 when he died. I underwent what I suppose is a classic conversion experience, from being a kind of fairly free and easy, free-spirited young person to being, strangely, a religious believer. But I didn't immediately embrace religion. I had to learn about and look into religion. And I ended up in the Catholic Church, became a Catholic, and became a Carmelite nun, you know, as one does. If you become a Catholic and you think, well, I want to do this properly. I could have become a Trappist, I could have become a Carthusian, but only if I'd gone to another country, because they don't have a lot of those in the UK. Whereas somebody I met told me about a Carmelite monastery, and I thought, wow, give it a go.
Halfway down the long drive, I stop and look back for a moment, expecting to see lights popping on in the windows, faces looking out. But there is nothing. No change, no movement about the sleeping house. The monastery slumbers. The low moon hangs vigilant over the hushed, teeming landscape. Cells are shuttered, slices of corridor seen from a distance, static, deadly quiet. And then, only then, at 100 yards, do I begin to breathe.
The book starts with a flash forward to when I ran away in the middle of the night after 10 years. And if you get to the end of the book, you'll see where the story is resumed, that I did go back after that for 2 further years. So I ran away after 10, but actually was there for 12 in the end. Yeah, so it's pretty dramatic. It wasn't the first time I'd actually left the cloister. I've been to the dentist once in 10 years, and I've been to the optician twice to get glasses. But we just, basically, we didn't go out. We were cloistered, which means enclosed, and that means we had a physical enclosure. We were separated from the outside world.
And you were basically in a cell living on rations.
Well, if you think about it, we all live within confined spaces of some sort, and we all live on rations. We nuns all had cells of our own. We considered ourselves hermits in community, because the Carmelite order comes from an eremitic tradition, which means a hermit-based tradition or desert spirituality. So living very solitary lives, albeit under one roof, was very important to us. So each one had a cell. And on rations, well, we had a vow of poverty and the life was very simple. And we did grow our own veg and didn't have any luxuries. So I suppose we were on rations.
And it seemed like quite a high school-like politic came into life there.
Well, it was an institution and, you know, it had its hierarchy and it had its tensions. So, yeah, I mean, I'd spent 10 years in a all-girls boarding school, two schools, but I was quite used to institutionalised life with other females. So it was sort of a bit like that, I suppose. But it had the kind of inbuilt tensions and power struggles that you get in very enclosed worlds, which is one of the things that made it very difficult after a while.
What's your relationship with religion now?
I think after all those years of living a very intense form of faith, I do still have faith, but my faith is much less dependent on the externals of religion. So I'm still a Catholic, but I also sometimes go to the Anglican or the Quaker meeting house or the Anglican church. So I'm a Catholic, but something of a slightly more independent-minded one than I used to be, and less intensely practicing, as in my practice is more focused on solitary reflection and prayer and simply just living in the presence of God. It's something that I sort of developed and that I sort of internalized during those years in the cloister. So the way I see it is God is wherever one is. You know, you don't have to be in church. Religion can train us to see God in things and to relate to God, but I don't think ultimately the externals of religion are what saves us. It's something internal, and it's about becoming a more honest and complete and loving and spiritually focused person. So I hope I'm still on that journey.
To stop and note the startling feelings that are welling up inside me. I'm astonished at the freshness of the night, amazed to find myself feeling safe, surprised at the sense of boundless space, surprised especially to hear my voice saying out loud, quite clearly and confidently, to God, or whatever guardian spirit may be listening, thank you, thank you, thank you.
Now, you narrated the audio version of Cloistered. How was that experience?
I really enjoyed recording it. I went down to the Penguin Random House Studios. It was really good fun in London. 4 days of sort of just constant talking into a, you know, a mic in a cubicle. Well, I enjoy that kind of thing. I mean, I like reading aloud, and I like, yeah, I enjoyed that. Especially as a child, I was Alice in Alice in Wonderland on Radio Oxford when I was 14. So I've always enjoyed words and reading aloud. I really enjoyed the studio experience. It was great, and I was really pleased that they let me do it. For me, because I've got a sort of, I'm a musician on one level, and for me, the rhythm of the words is important. And I think I sometimes leave longer gaps between sentences and let things settle in, and that's all been slightly edited out, as have some of my words have been slightly clipped. I don't know why. I mean, the editorial process is a different process from the actual reading, but I really enjoyed the reading. Yeah, I would do it again.
Now, it's out there in audio. It's accessible to people who, for whatever reason, can't see or can't access print. Is that important?
Obviously, it's hugely important because books are very, very important parts of our culture, and they're important ways of sharing experience and communicating ideas. So obviously, it's very important that people who can't actually read are able to enjoy the books and benefit from them. So yeah, I think it's really, really important that these things are made available. And also, you know, any sort of form of broadcasting on radio is really important because obviously some people rely more on hearing than they do on sight. And I think it's a really good thing that we've got so many audiobooks. I listen to loads of audiobooks. I love being able to go for walks listening. So yes, I think it's really good.
And then I am moving on again, breathless under the stars. I've taken virtually nothing with me, just my viola and a plastic bag containing a few necessities. When I next look back at the vast, towering house that rises like a fortress against the sky, I see it for what I now think it is, a place of danger and of dishonest murmurings. I look at it with relief and incredulity. Incredulity that this place held me for so long. Incredulity that I am safe. Incredulity at the beauty of the surrounding natural world. It is so good. Safe. 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 I am safe. I keep repeating to myself.
Cloistered, My Years as a Nun is available now in print, as an ebook, and in audio, both commercially and from RNIB Talking Books, as read by Catherine herself. That's it for our little taste of the Boswell Book Festival, the world's only festival for biography and memoir. And as I said at the start, I'm there right now recording for future editions of Read On. There are over 400 episodes available as a podcast, including previous visits to Boswell and to the Wigtown Book Festival. Just search for RNIB Read On in your favourite podcast app.
Books and accessible reading on RNIB Connect Radio.